I will open the Committee on Rules for May 26, 2009. Open a public hearing on 2005. And as soon as the committee administrator has a moment to, she'll give a brief overview.
She's not in the hallway. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2005-A requires person being paid to obtain signatures for a prospective petition for a state measure to register with the Secretary of State and complete training program. Prohibits registration by the Secretary of State of a person who, during the five-year period prior to a date of an application, has had a conviction of a certain criminal offenses involving fraud, forgery, or identification theft, or who has had a civil or criminal penalty imposed against them for violations of elections law. Requires Department of State Police to provide Secretary of State with information concerning criminal background of applicant for registration. Prohibits person from gathering signatures for prospective petition for which the person is being paid at the same time for one that they are not being paid for. Prohibits including signatures obtained in violation of this provision from being counted. Directs Secretary of State to prepare official templates for cover and signature sheets for prospective petitions for state measures. Requires use of official templates for signature gatherers. Requires chief petitioners to file signature sheets with Secretary of State on a monthly basis. Clarifies that volunteers are not subject to rolling turn-in requirements. Defines liability for instances where chief petitioners and contractors knew or should have known of election law violation. Includes penalties to up to $10,000 for certain election violation laws. And contains severability clause. Declares emergencies effective upon passage. You will find in your packet written testimony from the Oregon Business Association, Common Sense for Oregon, and testimony from Dan Meek.
Okay. I'm going to call the first two people up, and then the next person I will be calling up will be hopefully the Secretary of State. Kathy Eaton and Ross Day. Kathy, why don't you go ahead and start off? Ms. Eaton.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League is speaking today in favor of House Bill 2005-A engrossed. As you may recall, the League is a very long and very strong supporter of the right to direct democracy for the citizens of Oregon. And we supported the passage of House Bill 2082 in 2007, which was a major improvement in several critical areas of the initiative support system. And we support 2005, which would clarify the continue to protect the process. There are five particular points in 2005A that I would like to bring to your attention. Paid petitioners must register with the Secretary of State and receive training before petitions can be passed, rather than waiting until 1,000 signatures have been gathered. Second, the official Secretary of State petition templates for cover and signature sheets will now be prepared for prospective petitions rather than after the 1,000 signatures have been gathered. Three, chief petitioners would now file signature sheets each month, which assists the Elections Division in initiative processing and more evenly spreading the workload. Four, there is a clear separation between paid and unpaid petition passers, which the chief petitioner must verify. And fifth, the engrossed version brought the addition of a section on undue influence, which we think is particularly important. The League believes that House Bill 2005-A is an efficient and effective next step in improving the initiative process, and we urge the committee passage. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For your record, Ross Day, Executive Director of Common Sense for Oregon. I'm also a partner in Voice of the Electorate, LLC, We are a petition circulation firm. Best of my knowledge, we're the only one that's currently active in the state of Oregon. We're out circulating prospective petitions right now. I have approximately 25 employees working for me, and so I can tell you that this bill will affect me both in terms of something that's very important to me in the initial process, and also I suppose my business. I'll say this: I actually initially really liked the direction 2005 was going in. There are some parts of this bill that are really good that make a lot of sense. For instance, the background checks. Having the Secretary of State's office do the background checks, they can actually do them quicker than we do. We do background checks on our employees as it is. It's 10 days before we get our background check back. This bill says we're going to get a response back in 3 days. That really helps us. And it's also our understanding that you're going to get more information through the Secretary, if the Secretary of State makes a background check versus if we were. So there are some instances that we actually like to build. Some of the other stuff, like the prospective petition, registering with the Secretary of State ahead of time, that's really nothing more than paper pushing for us. It's fine. I understand the point, and that's really not going to add a lot to the burden. But I checked that we're against House Bill 2005 for some very significant reasons. And the first reason is Section 5 and Section 6 of the bill take out a very important protection, and I think raise serious concerns about where House Bill 2005 is going. Takes out, under the current law, the way it works is if a chief petitioner or contractor becomes aware of a potential violation of Oregon election law, if you notify the Secretary of State within 1 day of that particular, when you become aware of the potential violation, then you're absolved of civil liability. And there's a provision at the very end of that that says this section does not apply to criminal laws. Okay? In other words, the statute says a chief petitioner or contractor shall be held liable if somebody circulating a petition on their behalf violates the law. Then there's the get out of jail free card provision that I call it. And then there's the clear indication that this does not apply, that liability does not apply to criminal liability. In that section, in the House side, the Secretary of State introduced some language that says you basically impose a vicarious liability standard on chief petitioners and contractors alike, a civil vicarious liability. This change, which was, my understanding, was made in either the Dash 6 or the Dash 7's amendments that I didn't catch until after the bill had already passed the House, imposes criminal vicarious liability on chief petitioners and contractors, something that no employer right now in this state is subject to. No employer, unless you direct your employee to commit a criminal act, you're not liable for that criminal act. Let me explain how this would work. Under the current draft of 2005A, if I have a volunteer in Baker County, let's say, and he goes up to somebody and says, if you don't sign this petition, I'm going to beat you up. That's a Class C felony. Under House Bill 2005, I, as the chief petitioner, who had absolutely no idea this was going on, if that person is found guilty of the Class C felony, I, too, am guilty of a Class C felony under this draft of the law. I don't know how in the world that would survive any due process challenge. I don't know why in the world anybody would support that particular change in the law. It makes absolutely no sense. The Dash A10 amendments, which I've had drafted up, would fix that, would restore that important exception to that particular statute, and I'd hope that the committee would seriously consider those amendments and restore that protection. Otherwise, you're going to have the very real likelihood that you're not going to have anybody signing up to be a chief petitioner anymore. You want to kill the initiative process. This is the way to do it, because I, as an attorney, could never advise my clients, anybody, in good faith, that they should sign up for this, because it just takes one act out of 100,000, and you could be subject to up to 5 years in jail and $125,000 fine. That's ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. And I don't know if this was a mistake on the part of the Secretary of State's office or if this was something that was slipped in, but in any event, I think this is something that has to be changed. The second concern we have has to do with the early turn-ins. When the early turn-in provisions were initially proposed, we actually were in support of them, because what they actually proposed were you would turn them in and so they could be verified. So you'd have verification, kind of a rolling verification, which I think helps everybody, reduces the workload for the Secretary of State's office, reduces the workload for us as well. We don't have to actually hold on, keep possession of the signature sheets. Made a lot of sense. But that the early verification has been taken out, and now all that's required is a monthly turn-in. Well, what's the purpose of the monthly turn-in? There is no purpose. It doesn't not going to deter fraud in any way, because we already have to turn in signature sheets when they request our accounts, which is something that's required under House Bill 2082. So they're already going to get those sheets. What's the point of submitting early turn-ins, other than, I hope this isn't the case, but I know this has happened before in earlier petition drives, where opponents of a measure will go search through the petition sheets, figure out which circulators are the most productive, go harass them. I know in some certain circumstances they've actually had attorneys write and tell them that if they continue what they're doing, they're going to get sued. And also contact people who signed these petitions and said, hey, did you actually really mean to sign this? So I can't foresee a good public policy reason why the Secretary of State's office at the House, in front of the House committee, said, well, it was to deter fraud. Well, I'm not exactly sure how that happens. And it's supposed to speed up the process. Again, I'm not sure how that happens either if they're not actually verifying anything. All they're doing really is holding on to signature sheets. So those are our two biggest concerns with House Bill 2005. In my letter to the committee dated today, I've addressed a couple of other technical issues that I think ought to be addressed as well. I think they're just minor drafting errors as well. And with that, I'll end my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Day or Ms. Streeton? Yes, Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Day. This is back to your last point. My understanding, too, was that the provision for the monthly was to be able to expedite this process, do verification so it doesn't come all at once. So if that, and we'll hear from the Secretary as to whether that is really what is no longer going to happen, because I would at least on the surface kind of share what's the point of turning them in. I have a question for you, though, as an attorney, too, and as a petitioner. While you have petition signatures in your possession, have not yet been turned over to Secretary of State, is there any member of the general public have any right to come examine those petitions before they're submitted?
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, I do not believe so. This is an interesting theoretical question about who owns the petitions. We believe that until you turn those petitions into the Secretary of State's office, they're not public record. And so up to that point, then no, they're not. I suppose if somebody would file a lawsuit, they could discover them. But other than that, if a person came into a chief petitioner's office or into our place of business, I do not believe that they could gain access to those petitions. I don't believe so.
Okay. So if I could follow up, Mr. Chair. So at least the scenario that you've laid out, then by turning them in, I think we could probably say that they would then be a public record.
Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, absolutely.
And yet the process would not be complete. In other words, this is not an election, but it's an election activity, and you would be getting a snapshot out of it before the activity was completed. I would just say, Mr. Chair, that that issue bothers me, and I'm anxious to hear from the Secretary on that, because I think it is good to have signatures put in to relieve the work of the Secretary of State, but we're already talking about harassment and other things in the petition process. I would not want to have anything in that encourages that type of activity, that there should be, they should remain in the custody of the Secretary of State until they have determined that they are final or not before they would be a public record. You know, to me, it would almost be like intervening in an election process while the process was still taking place. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Any additional? Seeing none. Thank you both very much.
Thank
for
you.
Being. Secretary Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Kate Brown, I'm Oregon's current Secretary of State. I appreciate very much your hearing this bill today, and I'm sorry we got some signals mixed about when we were going to be on the schedule. So the focus of House Bill 2005 is to build on the work we did last session. You may recall we passed a little bill last session, the Initiative Reform Modernization Act, House Bill 2082, which gave us more tools to crack down on fraud and abuse in Oregon's initiative system. This bill, House Bill 2005, continues this work. As you, most of you know, I've been traveling around the state over the last year and a half and continue to travel, and I have to tell you the one sort of universal issue that I get agreement on from Oregonians is their frustration over the fraud and abuse in Oregon's signature gathering process in our initiative process. And this bill is designed to address those issues. I think you have in front of me, in front of you, my testimony, along with the House Bill 2005 highlights, which I would like to go over, unless the chair would prefer that I do a section-by-section analysis, which I'm also prepared to do as well.
The highlights.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
But if you'd like, you can read the bill word for word.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm sure each and every one of you is very capable of doing that. A couple of things. One, it gives us the tools to prohibit someone from registering as a paid signature gatherer if they're convicted of fraud, forgery, or ID theft. It applies the registration and training and criminal background check process that we passed in House Bill 2082 to the initial process, the prospective petition process, which requires the gathering of 1,000 signatures before you go to the ballot title process. As Mr. Day mentioned, it allows the Secretary of State to conduct comprehensive background checks to check the criminal history of protective signature gatherers. We don't want people who have had fraud or ID theft or to be paid signature gatherers. Requires petitioners to turn in original signatures once a month, providing more time for elections officials to process sheets and more time for petitioners to address problems. Mr. Day raised this issue in his testimony. The reason we did this is that 85% of the workload for elections is in the sorting pre-verification process. This provision will give the staff more time to complete this work and will decrease the mad rush at the end. It will allow for more careful review of petitions, and it will mitigate concerns over potential identity theft and forgery in the signature gathering process. We had proposed initially to move forward on the actual verification process. Because of the statistical requirements around the signature gathering process, we're not ready at this point in time to move forward on that. But we are very interested in moving forward at such time that we have the tools to do that. I think it makes sense to do signature verification because of the scientific statistical sampling method that we're required to use. We can't do it at this point in time. I know, I'm sorry, Senator Atkinson. So we would like to. We're not ready yet, and we support moving forward on that at some point in the future. The bill allows for concurrent civil and criminal enforcement of election violations relating to initiatives. Right now, we're required to limit both the type of violations that we can pursue. This would give us the full tools in the toolbox, complement, and help us work more closely with the Attorney General's office. The issue that has been raised, it makes chief petitioners liable when they should have known that a circulator has broken the law. The law now establishes liability only when the chief petitioner has knowledge. Again, this was part of House Bill 2082, and I appreciate Mr. Day's comments. We are holding people at the top accountable for the actions of people that work for them. Just like everyone anywhere else in Oregon law, employers have to share responsibilities for things that are done in employers' name. Right now, the law allows employers to turn their backs on acts of their paid signature gatherers, and this would prohibit, hold them to the reasonable person standard. I think you have the memo in front of you from Margaret Olney, special counsel to the Attorney General, giving you substantially more detail on this particular issue. Lastly, what I would say to that about this particular provision is this is not, as I told the good senator from John Day earlier, a situation where we're holding people to a standard of this is the day you're supposed to be wearing red shirts and somebody's got a blue shirt on. These are a serious initiative law violations. You have this list in front of you. I'm happy to go through it if you want. But these are paid signature gatherers, and they have been specifically trained not to do these violations. And the provision does not apply to volunteers. So, finally, the bill bars paid signature gatherers from also collecting signatures as volunteers at the same time. A few years ago, Oregonians passed a ballot measure, I think the number was ballot measure 26, which prohibits collections of signatures on a pay-per-signature basis. The only tool we have to enforce that law, frankly, is to prohibit paid signature gatherers from also acting as volunteers at the same time. And the bill would apply. There's no emergency clause on the bill. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I would like, Mr. Chair, to have legislative counsel also respond to Mr. Day's concerns.
Okay. Well, let's go to legislative counsel, respond first, then we'll go to general questions.
Okay. My name is Gina Zedlick, here from the Office of Legislative Counsel. Chair Devlin. I think, as Secretary Brown already articulated very well, there's a couple sections in the bill, specifically the amendments in Section 5 to ORS 260-561, which outlines what the type of liability a chief petitioner could be accountable for. I think, as Mr. Day pointed out earlier, we took out a provision that said that the section did not apply to a violation of law that is subject to a criminal penalty. And part of the reason that was taken out is because of some of the egregious statutes that we added, that if violated, they are egregious, and they are subject to criminal penalties. And so, therefore, that last language had to come out in order to accommodate those first ones. And again, this isn't a strict liability type of issue where if you don't know that one of your signature gatherers has done something that you would be held liable, you would have to overcome the reasonable person knows or should have known standard.
Okay. Questions for the Secretary of State or Legislative Council? Yes, Senator Nitz.
Thank you. And this may be for Gina, but whoever. Yes, just going back to what Mr. Day said. What Mr. Day said was that basically if a subcontractor or other individual, say, is found guilty of a felony act under this, that's prima facie evidence that you are now guilty without due process. Is that correct?
No, you would have to. Well, there's two things. If the chief petitioner had no idea of the violation, he can't be liable. He or she can't be liable. You would have to prove that the chief petitioner knew or should have known that they were liable. And if the chief petitioner, say, did know about it, they do have that. They can report to the Secretary of State and remove themselves from that liability.
Can I follow up on that?
Yeah.
So Along that same line, let's say that someone, well, they use the example of someone in Eastern Oregon saying, if you don't sign my petition, you know, I'm going to do something bad to you. And the chief petitioner learns of that, right? So, and takes action or notifies Secretary of State that, you know, I fired this guy. But the action has happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, could he still be liable even though after the fact, I mean, he can't undo it, but he has recognized it and has taken some step to either acknowledge to the Secretary of State that something has happened or whatever?
Yeah, Chair Devlin, Senator Metzger, that's correct. The person who violated would still be
right.
accountable and may be subject to criminal penalties. But, right, the chief petitioner can excuse himself from him or herself from that by notifying the Secretary of State if they knew about it.
Okay, follow up now on the other issue that was brought up about the collecting the signatures early, and I appreciate Secretary Brown your comments about wanting to do the evaluation because that was part of the thing I understood. I am concerned about, as you heard, about people using that in the middle of a process to try and either create doubt, create problems. I know that's happened, and I can see this would be something. You have talked about we still find this valuable for sorting and other things that I would see it be of value. Would you have any problem with saying that if this were to go forward and collecting these on a monthly basis, that these would not be public record until the Secretary of State certifies that the process has been completed and so that these are not used for harassing purposes by any organization. So that the only your possession for your work would be qualified until such a point as the signature collecting and or verifying process is complete.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I appreciate the concerns that are being raised around this issue. Before we throw out our public records law, which I thought might wake Senator Burdick up.
Well, Jelly wakes me up, but I'm concerned. I'm concerned that we're creating a public record that doesn't currently exist under a different concept.
Here's what I would say. Let's wait to see if there is a problem first. The legislature is going to be back in session in, I believe, in February of 2010.
Not sooner.
If not sooner. I think it would be appropriate, before we would close down access to these very important public records, that we wait to see if there's a problem. But in addition to that, we added information regarding the signature verification process to the state's undue influence laws, giving the Secretary of State's office more tools to go after people if this were to happen. So my comment regarding public records is let's wait and see if there is a problem. And in addition, we've added to our tools the ability to go after folks in the signature verification process regarding undue influence.
I need to follow up on that if I could, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
One more. But undue influence is to do something. The action has already happened. You know, the concern that was raised that I would have raised is someone trying to either harass or somehow intimidate people who have already taken action. Just like as you were in the Senate last time and the robocall bill we passed was to keep people from harassing people, maybe we could apply this that any contact by anybody who is in the process of this is a violation of those provisions. I mean, I think the idea is to protect the process where someone's integrity of participating in a process is their process, just like their ballot is, at least until such time that either you certify that it does or does not have the qualifying signatures. Because this is a very active process, as you know, and some people will try to seek any advantage.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I appreciate your concerns. Harassing or trying to influence folks who've signed petitions is not acceptable in any way. If this committee wants to change the law regarding that in terms of post-signature, I'm more than willing to accept those changes in another vehicle. But we frankly don't want signatures being counted or being verified in the open public, in open records. So we want, for example, good government folks, folks who want to watch this process happen. We think the record should be accessible to the public. I think that's a good thing. So I'd be really concerned about making these not making these accessible to the public.
Okay. Senator Atkinson, and then if we have too many questions after this, I'm going to close this public hearing and open another one, and people can come back to this bill at 6:15 or whenever we get back to it. Senator Atkinson.
Very quickly. Sorry, I have been in committee since 3, and I was going to ask you this beforehand, but your opening statement and the wait-and-see comments of the last round of questions leads to this question. You referenced the changes that were made in 2007. Has there been an increase in violators since 2007, or has it been flat, or did that not go far enough, or should we just wait and see?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, I believe that the only initiative that made it to the ballot under the application of House Bill 2082 was ballot measure 65, the open primary measure. So I think the answer to your question is we don't know fully the implications of House Bill 2082. I will say that there are circumstances that we believe that happened in terms of employers turning their backs on the work of their paid signature gatherers, that if they had taken reasonable care, they would have known that their paid signature gatherers were violating the initiative law. And that's why we were specifically asking for the should-have-known language in House Bill 2005. Some of the provisions, like requiring the paid signature gatherers in the prospective provision process, are new. We just did not cover that in House Bill 2082.
Okay. I have one question. This is for Gina, actually. If a chief petitioner were to designate another chief petitioner or a contractor under Section 2, subsection J, would the contractor still be liable for the liability outlined in Section 5?
Just pick that up on your own.
Oh, yes. It came to me right at the end.
Well, you have identified a piece of legislation that definitely was drafted to read more broadly than it was intended to. However, it's directly competing with all the other sections that we have that specifically say a chief petitioner is liable for these types of things, a contractor is liable for these types of things. So I think you would have an uphill battle arguing that that one little provision that tries to clarify that if a chief petitioner designates his neighbor, that suddenly the neighbor has all the liabilities and responsibilities that a chief petitioner has, which the intent of that section was to make sure that wasn't the case. However, I think the other statutes are stronger on that.
Thank you. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. These first questions are for the Secretary of State. The issues around the verifications are also a little troubling to me. It seems that the initial rationale for the verifications were to get a jump on the workload, you know, to get the signatures turned in monthly, to start verifying signatures, to sort of get a jump on the workload to avoid the mad rush at the end. But in your testimony, you indicated that that can't happen. Why is it that that can't happen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, 85% of the workload for the initiative process is done in the sorting pre-verification process. So by doing the monthly rolling turn-in, it'll give our election staff more time to complete the work. And as you said, it will hopefully avoid the mad rush of verifying hundreds of thousands of signatures at the end. In terms of the are you asking specifically regarding the statistical sampling process?
Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to find out what are the impediments. If you're asking for these records to be turned in monthly, I assume that you're going to process them monthly.
Correct. We will.
Okay, and then would that be just the signature verification process, or what other things will be verified?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I'm going to have the Deputy Director answer your question. the reason why we couldn't move forward on the actual counting of the signatures is because it would invalidate the statistical sampling method. And if you want to ask any questions regarding the statistical sampling method, I am not the person to answer them. So it's mathematical. Come on up, Brenda.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not just exactly sure this English major is going to understand the answer. About the statistical issues. It's about, I understand that you'd invalidate the statistical method by okay. sampling early. I get that part. But for whatever reason, there's a, you cannot complete the process until all the signatures are turned in and the period's over and you've got the entire body of work to use as the statistical base. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So at what will somebody be tasked with doing data entry of these signatures on a monthly? You don't have to come up.
Okay.
Just a nod is good.
Okay.
The affirmative
record,
is indicated.
The nod is in the affirmative.
Yeah. And those then will be on a searchable database. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think I share Senator Metzger's concern. Anybody who's been the happy recipient of robocalls during an election process based on those that have voted and those that haven't voted would chalk that up to a form of harassment. Some of these initiative processes are extremely volatile. It's no secret there are a lot of folks in Oregon who detest the initiative process and hate the outcomes. People are not shy about expressing the fact that they don't like the outcomes. And I would think that anything that virtually any mechanism that can be used to influence people that depends on a searchable database will be employed. So what in fact then prevents people from getting those harassing telephone calls at home when you don't know who's making the call and you don't have a way to verify, you know, for what purpose the call was made? Maybe you only have a anecdotal report to your office that somebody called and was unflattering about the fact that we'd signed a petition.
Mr. Chair, Senator Farioli, the reason why once initiative petitions are turned in now, after the staff has gone through the sorting verification process, those are public record. So what I would tell you is that the circumstances of signers being harassed after they've signed a petition are minimal, because there's no point in harassing someone after they've signed a petition. It's like, I mean, the biggest equivalent I can come up with is harassing someone after they've turned their ballot in about how they voted. The vote has already been taken. The signature has already been signed. And if anything, by harassing a signer of petition, you're going to get them more devoted to the cause that they signed for, as opposed to encouraging them to come on your side.
It
simply makes no sense.
Intimidation is a weapon that's used in a variety of ways. And if your objective is to intimidate petition signers, it won't take long for people to get the idea. If you sign a petition, you get phone calls. And I think that, you know, you're asking us to wait until after the fact to see whether or not it becomes a feature. And I guess I'm suggesting that if you're not going to be able to process these monthly turn-ins because of a statistical impediment, perhaps these need to become public record in due course when the petition is actually certified and statistically analyzed. That's the thrust of my issue, Mr. Chairman. I have other questions as well.
Okay.
Mr.
You want to respond, Madam Secretary? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, and this is a question I think that goes to legal counsel.
You thought you got away.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of merit in this bill, and if there was a part of the merit is that signature gatherers won't be felons, especially those that may have engaged in identity theft or fraud or similar sort of criminal behaviors. So if the person's passed that standard and gotten certified to be a petition gatherer, and they were trained, and they were educated about what was appropriate behavior and what was not appropriate behavior, and there was a very clear communication from the employer to the employee about what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. If an employee, through their own volition, took an action outside of that scope of work, wouldn't they be acting outside of the scope of employment?
Are you asking about the liability section and how that works? I think I would argue that violation of these statutes are in their scope of employment with that chief petitioner, and it's only, again, if they violate it, you know, it is of their own volition. It's just a question of whether the chief petitioner should reasonably have known about that, or whether the chief petitioner did know about that. I think it's trying to stop the ostrich type thing, where the chief petitioner puts their head in the sand when they know what's going on around them. That's what I would say.
Let me use an example. If I hire a subcontractor, or not a subcontractor, just an employee to paint houses, and I put them through a training process, and I give them reasonable certification and a reasonable supervision, and when I am not directly in their presence, they burglarize the house, is that within the scope of their employment?
I don't know, and I'm not sure what your question's actually, where you're trying to...
Well, the point I'm making is that occasionally people do things that are absolutely irrational and not necessarily the things that I want them to do as their employer.
Mr. Chair,
And they may have their own reasons for doing that. You know, they may be compensated in such a way that they feel it's their advantage to do something outside of the scope of the employment. And I guess I'm wondering if that creates an affirmative defense for the chief petitioner, or is a person liable for any crazy thing that an individual that does that might not have reasonably been foreseen?
Mr. Chair, Senator Farrioli, we're not asking to hold chief petitioners and the contracting firms accountable for actions of their employees outside the scope of their employment. The actions that we are asking to be held them responsible for is for very well within the scope of their employment. They include prohibiting false signatures, prohibiting bribery, prohibiting alteration or completion by circulator of date signed on signature sheets, prohibiting the use of threats and intimidation to gather signatures, prohibiting undue influence to sign or not to sign a petition. So these are specific prohibitions that the paid signature gatherers have been through and have been trained on and specifically know they are not supposed to do. And we are holding chief petitioners, the people who are hiring them, responsible for the actions of their employees if they knew or they reasonably should have known that their paid signature gatherers were violating these actions, which I would say are well within the scope of their employment.
Mr. Chairman, I can see that we're not getting anywhere with this questioning, but I would like to at least conclude for my own purposes. If I hire somebody to conduct themselves in a lawful manner and they do anything other than that, they are not working within the scope of their employment. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you for coming. I did want to note to the committee here that Mr. Mike Heinzman has been patiently sitting in back, just in case you had any questions about the background check provisions in the bill. He's with the Oregon State Police. So with that, I will close the public hearing. This bill will be scheduled for work session on Friday.
Did it have this much excitement when it was in the House?
It had more excitement.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, there was a lot more excitement in the House.
Oh, fantastic.
As usual.
Is that a challenge?
We are the contemplative body.
Mr. Chair, I'm well aware of that.
I will open a public hearing on HB 2621, and Representative Wisnett has been waiting very patiently. So, or 2619, I'm sorry. Do we have a... And Grover, why don't you go ahead and come up also, Mr. Simmons. Yeah, go over a brief overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2619 requires legislative council to solicit bids for printing of Oregon revised statutes each biennium. You'll find in your packet the fiscal statement on the engross measure.
What is this one?
It's a little bill.
A little bill? Is that right? That's for me to judge.
It's an important bill, but it shouldn't create as much controversy as the last one. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Gene Wisnett, State Representative, District 53. Good bill should pass. I'll come if the chair would let Mr. Simmons speak, then I'll give you the other questions.
Representative Wisnett, you've waited so patiently. Don't you have more to say than that?
I will, sir, but this is a good bill. It's a good business bill. It's good for the state of Oregon. And like I said, Mr. Simmons is going to talk to you a little bit about it. What happened is the legislative council has the authority to contract for printing our state statutes, the books over there behind the committee. And in 2003, they awarded the contract to a company in Missouri. And under the contract that they issued, they had the permission, or they were allowed to continue that same company, and there was no cut, there was no deadline. They've done it for two terms now. The amount of that contract was $400,000. So a company in Missouri has been printing your statutes since 2003, and at a cost of over $1 million that went to Missouri. So this bill is not saying that we couldn't award it to a company in Missouri again. It's saying we want to compete the contract. We're not going to extend it automatically to another company. This industry also, Mr. Chair and Senators, it changes drastically. I mean, look at how cheap it is to get things printed and everything now. So I think that was a mistake. Legislative Council testified in the House on this bill. We were disappointed. We were not able to stop the 2009 statutes from being printed with the same company without competing it. They've recognized that now. The bill before you is short, sweet, and says we will compete the printing of the statues in the future ever biennium. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be available for questions.
Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons, representing the printing industry. As Representative Wisnett has indicated, the issue which House Bill 2619 addresses is that 2 years ago, the contract to print the ORSs was automatically rolled over to a printing company in Missouri without being put out to bid in Oregon. And again, as he indicated, the value of the contract is about $450,000. So in the printing industry, that is a substantial amount, and it would have been nice to have had the opportunity to bid on that. One of the problems in manufacturing the ORSs is that it requires a web press to do it economically rather than a sheet-fed press. And there are not all that many web presses in the state of Oregon, so we've had some difficulty in getting in-state companies to bid on it. In 2005, for example, I contacted at least four printing companies asking them to please consider bidding. That included the Daily Journal of Commerce in Portland, Graphic Arts Center in Portland, Times Litho in Forest Grove, and CDS Publishing in Medford. And only CDS chose to bid on it. So the contract was let to Von Hoffman Printing in Missouri because they were the company with the lowest bid. So Oregon lost that bid, or lost that job fair and square, and we have no complaints about that. But in 2007, I went back to the Legislative Council's office to inquire the status of the project, and was told that the contract had already been rolled over without being offered in Oregon. So House Bill 2619 addresses that problem. It remedies the situation by requiring the Legislative Council to solicit bids each time the ORS is to be reprinted. Now, regrettably, the contract has been automatically rolled over twice, or again, without being put out to bid. So this bill is of a remedial nature, and it's one that I view is very much needed by our industry, and I urge the committee to give it favorable consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, District 7. And I signed on to this bill with Representative Wisnant because I thought it was pretty important. It's a bizarre sort of thing that we have in law that we can award a contract and not have to rebid it. I've been a contract employee for 25 years. My contract came up for renewal every 3 years. Every year it had a rollover provision. If they didn't like my work, they didn't have to roll it over to the next year. But every 3 years I had to fill out all this paperwork and do all this stuff to have my contract considered. Now, I won my contract every 3 years for 25 years, but that didn't mean that I didn't have to do the work. We should have to put these contracts out to bid. It just seems reasonable to me. And if an Oregon company doesn't get it, well, so be it. But at least they get an opportunity to bid on the contract. And I have to tell you, there are printing companies in my community who are going out of business and struggling to stay at work because fewer people are using the services of a printer. Many people are not printing anything anymore. I'm a paper person myself, and so I love my paper. Don't ever take my newspaper away from me. So they're struggling, and they just want the opportunity to bid. As Mr. Simmons indicates, it takes a special kind of press to print this kind of a document, but nonetheless, there are Oregon companies who can do that. So I just think in the sense of fairness that we should be putting these things out to bid and not favoring one company over another.
Any questions for any of the parties?
Statement, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Ever since we went to these, I thought they looked beneath the Oregon legislature.
Yeah.
Flimsy, junky, they do not look like the laws that govern this land. I always thought that. I always hated. When I got here, they were hardbound, they looked nice, they were proper. These things look horrible. And just as my... Just up here is a book I just made myself, hardback, for nothing. These, certainly, we can have better art direction than these flimsy things from Missouri. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming here to testify.
You're welcome.
Senator Walker, would you mind, presuming that this does pass, and that's a presumption, would you mind carrying this?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair, should you have the wherewithal to pass this bill out of committee.
Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing and open a work session on HB 2619A. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill to the floor, the do pass recommendation.
Okay, it's been moved to move 2619A to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, motion passes. Senator Walker, you will carry. Okay. I apologize to people that have been waiting here. I did not expect 2005 to actually take as long as that it did in this hearing. But 783, I am simply going to open a public hearing on 783, close the public hearing, and continue it till Friday. Okay, I'm opening a public hearing on SB 783, closing the public hearing on 783, and continuing it till Friday. Now, I'm going to open work sessions on SB 507 and SB 508. And during the period of these work sessions, we do have, I have two parties invited to explain an amendment that's before us, plus the committee administrator, Mr. Brian Beringer and Ms. Elise Brown. And I'd ask that you stay during the consideration in both of these work sessions. I'm opening a work session on SB 507. Could the committee administrator give a brief overview?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 507 requires managed health insurance, preferred provider organization insurance, to approve or reject a provider application within 30 days of receipt. Requires insurers that fail to approve or reject applications to reimburse providers for services after a 30-day period. There provides exceptions. You will find a -5 amendment. The -5 requires credentialing to be made within 90 days. Physicians will be compensated during credentialing period at non-participating or participating provider rates and provides exceptions. You will also find a statement from ONA in your packet, and there is a no revenue and a minimal expenditure impact on the -5s.
Okay. Ms. Barnes, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Behringer. I'm with the Oregon Medical Association, and the committee administrator has done a very nice job with Senate Bill 507, so I will just add that we are here in front of the Rules Committee because we took a little long in the Health Committee to get consensus on these amendments. We now have consensus on amendments, and we have before you a bill that will allow our providers to be paid at least at the non-contract rate for during their credentialing period, which is what we were trying to do, and we believe that the insurers are also happy with this product.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Elise Brown representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and for the record, representing our Oregon members here in the discussion, Regents, Kaiser, United Pacific Care, HealthNet, ODS, and Providence. And just to ditto what Brian said, the process began back in February, and I'm just going to speak very quickly on both bills, and was led through with Senator Bates and Senator Cruz in the Senate Health Care Committee, and Brian is accurate in saying that it has taken some time, but I guess the good news is that you have the providers and the carriers sitting side by side in agreement. So we would request that you move these bills with our full support today.
Okay. Stand at ease for a moment. Let me confer with my good colleague, who just happens to be to my right.
Move the dash. Oh, I'm sorry. Move the dash five amendments.
Okay, the dash five amendments have been moved to 507. Any discussion of the dash five amendments? Any objection to the dash 505 amendments? Okay, motion passes. Do I have a motion to move the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation?
Mr. Chair, I would so move.
It's been moved to move 507 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. I will open a work session on 508. Please proceed. Committee Administrator, give a brief overview, and then we will proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 508 requires health insurers to request refunds from providers within 12 months of date of payment and allow 6 months of payment of refund, declares emergency is effective upon passage. You'll find a dash 5 amendment in your packet, and the dash 5 amendment sets time frame for health insurer to make a request to provider for payment already received by the health care to 24 months, prescribes the conditions that a health insurer must complete to receive refund as a primary or secondary payer, prohibits provider from requesting additional payments more than 24 months after payment is received, gives provider 30 days to contest refund, an additional 30 days to pay, and failure to pay after 30 days results in future offsets, permits health insurer to request at any time a refund if the claim was the responsibility of a third-party payer or a government program, and if the TPP has already paid provider. Health insurance is not prevented from requesting refund from subscribers for monies paid to providers for uncovered services. Exceptions are included in cases where fraud is suspected, except dental-only insurers, Medicare, Medicaid, supplemental programs. Provisions preempt contracts if there's a conflict. Deletes emergency clause applies to contracts signed after January 1st, 2010. You'll find in your packet, again, a statement from ONA, a legislative council opinion related to the application to pharmaceutical benefits. And, again, we have no fiscal and, no revenue and a minimal fiscal on the Dash 5 amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Brian Behringer with the Oregon Medical Association. Once again, the administrator has done a very nice job. This is a bill that implements equal timelines for both the providers and the insurers. It was a great work group experience that we finally got there, and we support the Dash 5 amendments.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. Again, for the record, representing all of my Oregon members, Regents, Kaiser, United Pacific Care, HealthNet, ODS, and Providence, and everyone is in full support of the amended the amendments before you today. And I just also wanted to say for the record that Courtney Dresser did a great job. I believe she might still be in the back of the room, but she did begin the process in cooperation with Senate health care members back in February, so we're happy to be here today with consensus.
Any questions from the committee? Do we have a motion on the Dash 5 amendments?
So moved.
Okay. The Dash 5 amendments have been moved. Is there any discussion of the Dash 5 amendments? Is there any objection to the adoption of the Dash 5 amendments? Seeing none, motion passes. Is there a motion to move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended?
So moved.
Okay, it's been moved to move SB 508 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion passes. Senator Mona Sanderson will carry both bills. That concludes our work today, committee. We will be back Friday. It now looks as if our meeting on Friday will be at 1 o'clock, but of course it is subject to whether or not we have a Friday session. Next week, because all other policy committees are closed except for revenue and ways and means, I'm going to try to find a time that works for all of us because we will probably be meeting four or five times next week. So I would guess probably that time is going to be like 4:30 in the afternoon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I nominate 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
You can't get 1 o'clock.
I second.
Oh, that's right. My committee is still in.
Call for the question, Mr. Chair.
With that, we're adjourned. I'm thinking.